Grab your Bibles, guys. Mark chapter 8. That's where we're going to be. Page 1010 in the blue Bibles in front of you. If you don't have a Bible, we want to give you one. You can grab one out at guest services. And we're just marching through, continuing to march through this gospel. We started in October. We're going to end at Easter. And the first eight chapters, a big theme has been who Jesus is, more specifically, his authority. His authority over all of these different realms, and he gets to speak in and all these sorts of things. And generally, the disciples' response to Jesus has been, who is this? Who is this man that the wind and the waves obey him? And so there's just been this confusion. Mark chapter 8 is right smack dab in the middle. There's 16 chapters long. And Mark is 16 chapters long. And what you see is now the whole gospel changes from this idea of, okay, well, who is the Messiah? He now defines what the Messiah means and what he does. And it's all about discipleship. What does it mean to be a follower of Jesus? And those two themes, what the Messiah means and what does it mean to be his follower, is what we're going to see this morning as he talks about this mission in Mark chapter 8. So we stand when we read the Bible at Calum's Alliance. It's because we think this book is different, that it's authoritative. Yes, you guys know if you're willing and able, look at that, you beat me to it. You can stand and we'll read the words of scripture together in Mark chapter 8, verse 27. This is the word of the Lord for us this morning. It says this: Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say that I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." Jesus warned them to not tell anyone about him. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," he said. "You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Verse 34. Then he called the crowd to him, along with his disciples, and said, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels." Lord, I pray that you'd speak again to us, and that our answer to the question of who do we say you are would be accurate and authentic. In your name I pray. Amen. You can have a seat. Like I said, two big ideas. What does the Messiah mean? And what does a disciple mean? That's what we're going to look at here this morning. If you keep your Bibles open, I just want to walk you through. It starts off in verse 27. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. Mark is giving us a clue. Where are we at? We're in Caesarea Philippi. To us, it doesn't jump off the page, but to the original hearers of this message, it would. Caesarea Philippi is 24 miles north of Bethsaida, Chorus, and Capernaum. There's a map behind me that shows. Generally, Jesus did 75-80% of his ministry in the Galilee region, the northwestern part of the Galilee, in those three Jewish tri-cities. This is where you would stay if you were a Jew. This was home base for you. Caesarea Philippi, you can see, is north of that, 24 miles north. Jesus, on foot, brings, as a Jewish religious rabbi leader, brings his Jewish disciples to Caesarea Philippi. No go. You would never do that. Why? Because Caesarea Philippi is a Roman stronghold city. It was Caesar Augustus gifted it to Herod the Great. Herod the Great gave it to his son Philip, who named it, enlarged it, and named it Caesarea Philippi. This was where the Romans would live. This is where they had their parties. This was a hotbed Roman city. Jewish disciples and their rabbi don't go there. They also don't go there because all of the cultic practices and worship that happened in Caesarea Philippi. If you went to Caesarea Philippi today, you can. I've been there twice. At the core of the religious atmosphere of Caesarea Philippi was worship of the cultic god Pan, P-A-N. This was a fertility god of the shepherds. And worshiping Pan involved grotesque sexual activities. I can't even get into it in this audience. It's R-rated. The disciples, where are we going? Why would we ever go there? Because it was godless. And here they are in Caesarea Philippi. This was the context that Jesus brought these Jewish disciples into. And while they are in this environment around the villages of Caesarea Philippi, they know what's going on. Jesus asked them this question: who do people say that I am? What's the consensus when people think about me? What's the general population's thoughts when it comes to who I am? Well, they answer in verse 28. They replied, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, one of the prophets. Well, John the Baptist, he's a pretty significant figure. He's a good guy. Elijah, my goodness, one of the prevailing concerns or the prevailing thoughts of the first century is that when the Messiah comes, he's going to be a lot like the Old Testament character Elijah. So check mark there. Or one of the prophets. All of these are good things. In other words, his disciples report back to him and say, in the polls, you're doing quite well. The consensus opinion of you, check, 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 you're doing quite well. The context is in Caesarea Philippi. He asks them, who do people say that I am? With the backdrop of all this paganism, they say, well, you know, generally, people think pretty well of you. But then he goes one step further. He gets uncomfortably specific with his disciples because he doesn't leave it there. In verse 29, he says this, but what about you? He asked, who do you say that I am? It's not good enough just to have a consensus opinion of who Jesus is. He needs a confession. Who do you say that I am? He's trying to bring his disciples out from, it's okay that, yeah, everybody thinks well of me, but I'm trying to remove you from that group, and I want you to plant a flag. A confession of who I really am. Who do you say that I am? See, it's not good enough to ride on the coattails of other people's opinions about Jesus, your families. He's asking you to, as he draws the line in the sand, cross that line and confess who he actually is, or at least figure out your answer to that question. Who do you say that I am? See, he's calling for radical commitment. Radical commitment to him. It's not a kind of, sort of, seasonal commitment. It is a, I am in on who you are, Jesus, and I cross that line. See, we live in a very, very, very commitment-afraid culture. Like, when TELUS comes at me and wants me to renew a 3-year contract for the internet, I'm like, 3 years? That's an awfully big commitment. We don't want to commit. We want to weigh our options. We want to see if something better comes up. And yet Jesus still pushes and asks them and you, who do you say that I am? And in so doing, challenges any nominal allegiance to him. Are you in or not? See, this challenges in our culture thin belief. I just read a great book. It's called Disruptive Witness by Alan Noble. He's a PhD from Baylor, an English professor. And in his book, he talks about speaking truth in a distracted age. And he says what we are good at in our culture is picking up and putting down beliefs, which are thin beliefs. Because of all of the information that we're wading through online, everything's coming at us so quickly that we can pick up and put down beliefs so quickly without really ever thinking through them and ultimately misrepresenting those beliefs. So here's an example. A few weeks ago, it was Martin Luther King Jr. Day. We can all agree that Martin Luther King Jr., a prominent figure in human history, had an important message and did great things, right? So once a year, we celebrate Martin Luther King Jr. Day, which is absolutely great. But what we do is we get up in the morning, go online and see, it's Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Oh my goodness, he's so important. So then we go and we Google Martin Luther King Jr. quotes and we grab the best one. And then we throw it up online, right? We say, this is the most important thing in the entire world, and everybody needs to know that I am a champion of Martin Luther King Jr. and his beliefs. And then we go to bed that night, and we put it down. The next day, we watch Netflix. We watch a documentary about whales in captivity. We say, absolutely not. Whales in captivity, there's no way that that's okay. And then we pick up and champion that cause. We pick it up and put it down, pick it up and put it down, pick it up and put it down. Thin belief. It's a way that we express ourselves, that we want to be known for championing these causes. And Jesus, by asking this question, and actually the whole weight of this text, is that you cannot hold a thin belief with him. You don't pick him up and put him down as it's convenient for you. Who do you say that I am? Peter answered, you're the Messiah. Ding, 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 ding. Peter gets it right. Peter gets it right. You are the Messiah. Jesus warned them not to tell anyone. Jesus goes on in verse 31. Read with me. He says, then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. We go from the disciples' confession to the suffering Messiah. Peter just said, you're the Messiah. You are the one who's going to save us. You're the anointed one. You're going to come in and save us. And then Jesus defines what being the Messiah actually means. It means that he is going to suffer and die. This is the first of three predictions that Jesus gives like this over the next few chapters leading to the cross. He speaks plainly, the text says, that this is what it means to be the Messiah. You see, Peter had a different definition. We can see this playing out. Verse 32, he spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Oh, Peter. So Peter has this definition of what it means to be the Messiah that doesn't involve the whole going to your death thing. So Peter, being the smart guy, you know, puts his arm around Jesus. Hey, come over here. Come over, Jesus. Come here. Puts his arm around him. He goes for a walk. And okay, so I know you just said all that suffering and death stuff, but you don't mean that. You don't mean it. That's not what Messiah means. See, because for Peter, being the Messiah didn't mean suffering and surrender. It meant success and submission. That what Peter wanted, and the prevailing view of the Messiah, was that the Messiah was going to come in and be one like David, King David in the Old Testament. Because King David in the Old Testament, the view of King David was that he was the warrior on the horse with his sword drawn and blood dripping from his sword. He was the conquering Davidic king that really established the nation of Israel. And so Peter thought, no, Jesus, what my definition is that you are going to come and get rid of these Romans. We can establish our land and you can drive them all out. And you are going to be successful and make others submit to you. And Jesus says, that's not the definition of Messiah. Because Peter wants the Romans out, but Jesus has come not to get the Romans out, not to do battle with the Romans, but instead to do battle with Satan, sin, and death. And the pathway forward for the real Messiah wasn't through triumphing on a horse, but through dying on a cross. And this didn't compute. And in doing so, Jesus completely inverts what it means to be the Messiah. So counterintuitive, but yes, he will come and save. He did come and save, but not by getting the Romans out, but by dying for the sin of mankind. Not taking on Caesar and his foes, but Satan and his demons. And the pathway forward for the Messiah was to sacrifice himself for you and for me. And it's with that understanding of who the Messiah is that he asks you today, who do you say that I am? So it means to be the Messiah. It continues on. Verse 34 says this. When he called the crowd to him along with his disciples. He's now defined Messiah. Now he's defining what does it mean to be a disciple. He calls the crowd with him and his disciples. You see, up until this point, that it's been pretty cool to be with Jesus. He's doing miracles, teaching cool things, raising people up, healing legs, all that sort of stuff. So it's like, man, this is a cool place to be. It's easy to attract a crowd. It's harder to keep a disciple. So the crowd's with him. His disciples are with him. And then he has to go and do something like this. He says, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. Wah, wah. This is a space maker sermon he's about to preach, right? Because it's not the cool, flashy, it's like, all right, here's the entrance, guys. Here's what it means. You take up your cross, you die to yourself, you follow me. So all the crowd gets thinned out a little bit. It's a space maker. And he says, this is what it means to be a disciple. It's not just riding on my coattails to see me do cool things. No, he says three things. Whoever wants to be my disciple must, number one, deny themselves. Number two, take up the cross. And number three, follow me. Let me unpack that for you. First thing, to be a disciple means that you deny yourself. Deny yourself? Come on. See, here's what I know. Is that the whole universe revolves around me. I know that for a fact. If you didn't know that, I'm just bringing you in. The whole universe, like, all of the lights in Kamloops, the traffic lights, revolve around me and my schedule. And if they don't obey, I talk to them in my car. See, my family has a hard time understanding this, but it's clear as day to me that my household revolves around me. The whole universe, actually. It all revolves around me, what I think, and my schedule, and my time, my priorities, my treasure, everything revolves around me. And Jesus comes at us this morning and he says, actually, to be a disciple of Jesus is to remove yourself from the center of the universe and put me in it. It's to dethrone yourself from your life and put me on it. To deny yourself. To deny how you think things should go. To deny your primal instincts. To deny what you think is best. To deny your prized life. And to say, Jesus, you now are in the center of my life and all of those things revolve around you. This is so anti-me. This is the opposite to self-absorption, self-admiration, self-pity, self-indulgence, self-reliance, self-seeking, self-assertion, and selfishness. To be a disciple of Jesus is to listen to the words of Jesus and to say you have to deny yourself. Space maker. To deny yourself. So the question I think that we all have to grapple with this morning, if you consider yourself a follower of the way of Jesus, is what area of your life, or in what area of your life, is God asking you to say no to you and yes to him? A submissive, yielded spirit to his spirit. Where are you asking me to say no to me and yes to you? That's what it means to deny yourself. It gets worse, guys. Jesus says, next, take up your cross and follow me. Self-denial. What does that look like? It means taking up your cross. Can you believe this? That the central metaphor or image in the mind of King Jesus when it comes to being one of his followers is to pick up a cross, an image of death, and march behind him to your own death. (Laughs) Like the cross is an image of pain and torture and death. And Jesus says, I want you to follow close to me as I carry my cross, I want you to carry your cross. My cross is your cross. My life is your life. My death is your, my resurrected life is your resurrected life. But it first starts with a cross. To take up a cross and march to your own death. Welcome to the country club, folks. To take up your cross. So what does that mean? What does it mean to take up a cross and follow him? See, sometimes we think of a cross as like any difficulty that you face. No, it's not any difficulty. Like you not getting soy milk at Starbucks this morning, not your cross to bear. Your mother-in-law, not your cross to bear. Right? We have all these things like first world problems that, oh, it's just my, no, it's not your cross to bear, okay? Okay, it's not your cross to bear. A cross is any difficulty that you face because of your allegiance to Jesus. Because of your allegiance to Jesus. That's what it means to take up a cross. So what could that look like in the West? You see, there's some places that if you are a Christian in our world, if you live as a Christian in some places, you will actually might face your death. That's like, that is happening. That's reality. I know for us in the West, like what? Yes, that does happen still. But chances are in Kamloops in 2019, you're not going to actually give up your life. But you will have to give up some things. Let me outline maybe a few of them. For those of you in high school or young adulthood, you're trying to find the one, right? So you're trying to go out and you've got all the feels and you make yourself smell nice and you know, they're pretty and you're in a relationship and you're doing the dance of like, oh, they didn't text me back soon enough. You're doing all that stuff, you know. And so to take up your cross in that situation is to really understand and do an analysis of, is this relationship stirring up your affections for Jesus, bringing you closer to him, or is it not? And to take up your cross is to sit down and end the relationship because you know it is not what you should be doing. A difficulty you face because of your allegiance to King Jesus. For others of us, to take up your cross means that as you see in your industry, as you see in your workplace, that everybody else is getting promoted. Everyone's climbing up the ladder and you aren't climbing at all. In fact, you may be going down. And the reason that you are not climbing up that ladder is because the people above you don't think you have what it takes to be cutthroat enough to make the hard decision to cut the corner, to lie still and cheat your way up, because they know that you follow Jesus. You are one of those church-going people. That's a cross that because you have aligned yourself with Jesus, you face that. A cross that some of us should bear is to sign up to go to Mexico. And face difficulty, be uncomfortable for a bit, eat different food, sleep in different beds, be tired, expend yourself for the sake of others. That's a cross. For others of us here to take up your cross now, it means that you forgive somebody. Even when everybody says don't, they don't deserve it. You know that more than anybody else because you're the one that's hurt. But because of the teaching of Jesus and his radical forgiveness of you, you take up your cross and you forgive. To take up your cross for some of you parents means that you live in this tension of prioritizing spiritual things in your home, attendance at your local church, and still try to help them be good at things they're good at. And they're like, why can't I go and do this more? Because it's Sunday and we go to church. A difficulty you face in your parenting because of your allegiance to Jesus. To take up your cross in your parenting means that you prioritize the things of God. Despite knowing that they're really good at soccer. That's what it means. It means that, man, when you haven't had a good year in your business, you continue to give generously to people and to your church because this is what Jesus says to do. I think to be a follower of Jesus, to take up your cross, what that means mostly for everybody in this room is a loss of your reputation. That more and more so we're going to have to be okay walking from our family's house, our workplaces, our conversations with friends, knowing that they are snickering behind your back because you believe this. And at the end of this, if anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them. Who do you say that he is? Radical commitment to Jesus. It's heavy. So heavy. And I think if we just end it here, it's like, oh man, I don't like that. I don't like this. It's all this self, like, especially if you're new to church, you come, man, this is a really hard message for you to hear right off the bat. But if we don't get this next part, I think we don't fully understand the whole picture. Because it says this in verse 35, for whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world and yet forfeit their soul? In other words, all of this self-denial, all this taking of the cross, all this following Jesus, an active participation in the life of Jesus, to follow him. We do all of that. We sacrifice that. We sacrifice the way that we think it should go because he has a better life for us. Whoever wants to save their life will lose it. That we open our hands with our own life and say, it is yours, Lord, because you have something better for me. It's a comparison of value. That's what he's asking us to do. What good is it for you to gain the whole world but forfeit your soul? That Jesus is coming at us today and asking us, are you experiencing the life that I have given you? The promised life. Because if we don't experience that life, all of this is begrudging submission. Oh, I'll take up my cross again. Oh, I'll follow you, I guess. But if we don't experience that life, this is all we have. There's no joy. But Jesus is coming and saying, man, I got so much more. The life that you have wanted only happens when you lose it for me. You only get the life you want if you actually. And in doing, he inverts what it means to be the Messiah, and he inverts what it means to live the good life. That we get the good life on his definition, not our own. So what is life like? What is that life like without God? So this may be helpful for you if you're checking us out, checking Jesus out, checking Christianity out. What is life like without God? I think living in the West, life is defined by secularism, the marginalization of God and anything transcendent. We push to the margins. And so there's a Christian philosopher, actually a Catholic philosopher. His name is Charles Taylor. In 2007, he wrote a book called A Secular Age. Groundworking, huge book. Not that huge book. About what it means to live in a secular age. One of the predominant themes in his book is he calls us living in the West, living in the imminent frame. Here's what he means. We live in a big dome. A big dome. And inside this dome, there is no transcendent reality at all. Secularism, naturalism, there is no outside forces that are involved in this world. Because of that, every single person living in this dome is charged with making up meaning on their own. What is the purpose of life? What's the end goal here? Everybody is charged with defining that for themselves. In this imminent frame, there seems to be a malaise, he says, a yearning for more, but there's got to be more, but there isn't, because all I have is what I can see, feel, touch, and experience. There's no more to that, to life than this. So he says, life in the imminent frame has a malaise because all we do is we desire and consume and desire and consume and desire and consume, repeating. We have a desire, we fill it. We have a desire, we fill it. But he says, what ends up happening in this imminent frame without any transcendent reality is that we end up going on a treadmill and we never get satisfied. Life in the West without God is characterized by freedom. We are free to be me, free to do what I want, free to go anywhere I want, be whoever I want, do whatever I want. Meaning, purpose, ethics, value, all given to the individual to decide. That's what it means to live in the secular West. This freedom that we've all been given is a great thing, but we have too much of it in the West. It's like putting a huge engine in a car and not having a steering wheel. Because we have nowhere to direct that freedom to. No lasting purpose other than our own primal instincts. All the freedom in the world, but so much anxiety. Because we have choice anxiety. What do I choose? What's ways best? What worldview? What thing? What do I do? What belief? It's like going to one of those restaurants and the menu's 30 pages long. And you know in your gut, you can't do a steak and crepes well, both. Impossible. That's what we are faced with life without God in the West. Choice anxiety. Who am I? What's the purpose? What do I build my life upon? Is this there's no rudder to our ship. Life in the West, characterized by freedom, this malaise, it's also characterized by radical connectivity. We are the most connected people we've ever been, and yet the most anxious and lonely people we've ever been. We have more ways. Do you realize we have more ways in 2019 to be happy than ever before? Generally speaking, life is good for people in the West. And yet we still are looking because some of us are running on that treadmill so fast. Desire, consumption, and it doesn't fulfill you. That's what it means to live with God, life here in the West without Jesus. 36-year-old Marcus Pearson made a video game called Minecraft. At the age of 36, he sold it, I believe, to Microsoft for $2.5 billion. 36 years old. In the summer of 2016, he tweets out this. The problem with getting everything is you run out of reasons to keep trying. Hanging out with a bunch of friends and partying with famous people, able to do whatever I want, and I have never felt more isolated. What good is it to gain the whole world and yet forfeit your soul? And here's the thing. So most people in this room right now are thinking, yeah, of course, like I get that. Like everybody, like money can't buy me happiness. Like everybody knows that, except you think you're the exception. Right? Like somehow I will be different than everybody else that's ever lived. And so some of us are sacrificing everything for this life, now. And Jesus is saying, no, the life that you want, you have to sacrifice your very life. You have to step over that line. You have to follow me. And this is the life that you've always wanted, because as Jesus defines our life for us, we start to experience something that we never thought possible. Because Jesus comes to us and gives us different mental maps for our life. Mental maps about sexuality, about generosity, about forgiveness, about life and community, about purpose, about the end, about paradise, about everything. He gives us a different way to think. He starts to say crazy things like this, is that if you want to be happy, you be a servant. If you want to be rich, you give everything away. If you want to be full, you die to yourself. You love your enemies. You be meek. If you want to be first, you got to be last. It's so counter to what you want that you have to investigate it. And as you start to experience this life, the life to take up a cross, to deny yourself and to follow, is such a small cost in comparison to what you get in him. And there comes a joy. There comes a joy when all of the fleeting stuff, the temporal stuff that you experience in that life, you have a sense of eternity's place in your heart, and you start to live that out, and you start to obey Jesus, and you start to feel his affirmation, his power in your life. You start to view things differently. You start to have joy when other people succeed, when before it was all about you, and you have this change in your life, and it's so beautiful. And then you realize, I have lost my life, but I found true life. So are you experiencing this life? Or is it just begrudging submission? There's more. It's a great time for us to come to communion. This whole service leading up to this moment. As we get to decide, who do you say that I am? Every single one of us. So this is a great moment for us, if you are a follower of Jesus, that you say, you know what, I am one. Count me as one of his disciples, a follower of the way of Jesus. If you're not, and you're living this life, you're on this trend of desire consumption, and it's not working, it is high time for you to stop and to give your life, and in doing so, find his life. And at the communion table, we celebrate the fact that he gave up his life, that his definition of Messiah was way different than what we thought, that he had to suffer and die. So this is a moment where we as a church come together and say yes. The bread simply represents his broken body, and the juice, the blood that he shed. The servers are going to come up. And as they do, I want you to be thinking about a few things. I'll ask you again, what is one area of your life where God is asking you to say no to you, but yes to him? To deny yourself. And then, are you living the life that Jesus has died for you to live? The band's going to come out, the service can come up, and we're going to distribute this. And in doing so, plant a flag as you answer the question, who do you say that I am? Follower of Jesus, you say, you are Lord of my life. What do you want me to do? So God, I pray that you meet us in this moment. As your church comes and takes communion, pray that we would do so cognizant of the life and your death and what it means. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.